Rambeth Bloodhouse report says her fatal wounds appear to be the result of several blows to the head.
They conclude that these injuries result of a homicidal attack.
That's inflammatory. That's not a doctor. That's what a jury determines.
This is going to be a long and arduous trial.
Kathleen Peterson, after drinking some wine and some champagne and taking some Valium, tried to walk up a narrow, poorly lit stairway in flip-flops, and she fell. She bled to death.
And we say on the other hand that she died a horrible, painful death at the hands of her husband, Michael Peterson.
The DA has to win. That's it. He doesn't care how. And basically, but by the same token, my lawyer, they want to win. Truth is lost.
I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
And today we're going to continue our three-part series on the Steer case, the case of Michael Peterson. And what we're going to do today is we're going to cover episodes 4, 5, and 6. Where we left off at episode 3, Elizabeth Ratliff's body had been transported from her grave in Texas to North Carolina for a second autopsy. So let's just get our beer review and then we'll get back to it.
Thank you, Jill. So I figured since we were dealing with a death in Germany that we would do a German beer today. And the one I chose is an Urbach from Echt Schlenkerer Rauchbier Company. Rauchbier is German for smoke beer. And let me tell you, it is smoky. So the beer in this nice cylinder glass is a very deep reddish-brown color. It has a pretty tan head and a little bit of lacing to it. The aroma is pretty much all smoke, and there's some caramel malt that you can detect. And the taste follows that pretty consistently. Maybe a little smoked meat, but definitely smoke, caramel, and toffee. It's a wonderful beer. But like I think any Rauch beer, any smoke beer, a little goes a long way. So you're not going to be drinking a lot of these at one sitting. And then one final thing, I would be remiss if I didn't tell people that this is the 500th anniversary of the German Reinheitsgebot, which is the purity law about beer brewing. And this law states that beer can only have the following ingredients: water, barley, and hops. Very simple.
Huh, I did not know about that.
500 years.
All right, well, let's crack that open. I'd like to try it.
Give it a go.
You brought me a bottle, I assume.
I did.
Okay, so last week when we did episodes 1, 2, and 3 of The Staircase, we started out with Mike Peterson finding his wife Kathleen Peterson dead at the bottom of the stairs, lying in a large amount of blood. So we went through his arrest and subsequent stuff and other events that came after. And when we left off, there had been a connection made by the prosecutor of a death back in 1985 of a neighbor of Michael Peterson and his first wife, Patty. Her name was Elizabeth Ratliff, and she coincidentally was found at the bottom of her stairs the morning after having dinner with Michael and his wife, Patty. Now, when they did the autopsy in Germany, it was determined that it was natural causes, that she had an aneurysm or a stroke and fell down the stairs. So when they brought her back to North Carolina for her second autopsy, the prosecution hoped to prove that Elizabeth Ratliff was also murdered by Michael Peterson, and the defense was hoping it would prove for them that Elizabeth Ratliff died of natural causes. So about 8 weeks before the trial began, the autopsy results came in, and to the prosecutor's dismay, it was found that Elizabeth Ratliff died from a homicidal attack.
You don't mean the prosecutor's dismay, do you? To the defense's
dismay. Sorry, I meant the dismay.
Yes, I mean the prosecutors must have been very ecstatic that somehow this was ruled a homicide.
Absolutely. I meant the defense. We see the defense in the film getting the results, and they're not very happy about it. Of course, probably, well, if you think Michael Peterson's guilty, then you think he wasn't surprised. But let's just say that the defense was not happy with it, right? Because the defense was hoping that this would be, you know, would back up that it was a natural death. So, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that besides the defense not being happy, they had a neuropathologist witness or someone who reviewed the autopsy results, and they felt that there was some inconsistencies there in the pictures and the diagrams. So they weren't able to rule out homicide, but they weren't able to rule out a fall down the stairs.
Yes.
So it sounds like it's still kind of open.
Now, one who really seemed outraged was Michael Peterson's defense attorney, David Rudolph, and he made a good point, which I pretty much agree with, as why would a medical examiner say homicidal attack? Isn't a medical examiner supposed to say the physical injury that caused the death? How do they know it was a homicidal attack? According to Rudolph, this was very inflammatory.
Well, I'm sure it was very inflammatory. And no, I don't see how you can make that judgment based on the autopsy results. I mean, all you can say is that here's what happened. And then, as the defense attorney says, the prosecutors have to prove that it was a homicidal attack.
Right. So according to David Rudolph, he says that the DA delayed the exhumation of Elizabeth Ratliff until 7 or 8 weeks before the trial, and he filed a motion to determine the admissibility of Ratliff's death. So,
well, I can certainly see where he'd get upset with that, because it sounds like the prosecutors are trying to work it so that they can have the maximum coverage prior to trial.
So he had actually subpoenaed the medical examiner to try and get to the bottom of this, and it was actually thrown out. Now, Orlando Hudson, the judge, he said that he agreed with the prosecutor that they could bring it up and decide if they were going to have it in trial whenever they wanted. They could not be pushed to do it at this point.
Right, but it wasn't being introduced at that point.
No, they just
this was something that they were going to consider down the road.
They wanted to keep their options open, but I'm pretty sure that they had planned on using it, I would think.
Well, absolutely.
Yes.
It's pretty inflammatory.
Yes. So there was a lot of implications from Michael Peterson and his attorneys that Orlando Hudson, the judge, may have had some political reasons for his decisions. So I did a little research on the judge, and the Honorable Orlando Hudson, Jr., he is a senior resident superior judge. As of 2003, he still is in the Superior Court. He received his Doctor of Jurisprudence from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's also formerly a district court judge for 4 years, and he was assistant DA in Durham. In addition to that, he has 2 years' experience with a private law firm.
Yeah, but it sounds like he was mostly on the prosecutorial side and not on the defense side.
Seems that way, yeah.
Not implying any bias on the judge's part.
No, and I'm not implying it either, but definitely Michael Peterson and his defense team did believe that there were some political issues, some corruption coming into play there.
Yeah, but that's just normal stuff in a high-profile case like this. I mean, there's going to be things that happen that the prosecutors think are wrong, and these things are going to happen that the defense thinks are wrong.
Right.
And they're going to argue about it and say, oh, it's not fair. But that's how you play the game.
Mm-hmm. So the trial began on July 1st, 2003. So in the documentary, we see the night before preparation for the trial, where David Rudolph is talking to Michael Peterson about how to dress, to be neatly shaven, to look neat and clean. Also, what's brought up by the jury expert is that it's very important that Martha and Margaret be in court every day.
Those are the kids that were adopted.
Right, yes.
Are the children of the deceased German woman.
Yes, they are Elizabeth Ratcliffe's biological daughters, who he raised from childhood to adulthood.
Yeah.
And is supporting through college at the time.
Yeah, I would think that'd be a big thing, that they needed to be there and show their support for their adoptive father.
Yes. Also, the jury expert says that, you know, it might be tough to sit there and hear what some people will be saying about you, saying you're a murderer, you're a liar, all these things. So you want to be able to sit there and be calm. And David Rudolph says your attitude as you sit at the defense table should be, thank you for coming and thank you for being so honest, no matter who the witness is or what they're saying about him.
So even when they're saying all sorts of inflammatory things, he's supposed to sit there and keep a calm demeanor.
Yes, yes. Because, of course, the jury's going to be watching him and how he behaves. I can't imagine the pressure of that. How do you act? If you smile, you're going to look cold and callous. If you cry, they'll say, oh, he's faking it. It's just really, I mean, a tough place to be in.
Yeah, I think there'd still be some ways to show that you don't agree with the testimony or that you do agree with the testimony.
Okay. You know, how would you do that? Nodding, shaking your head?
Yeah, I think you could look in general agreement with things or make a cross face or, you know, without jumping up and screaming, you're a fucking liar.
Right. I'm sure it's tempting to do. It's so hard to
hear people
knock you down like that.
Absolutely.
I mean, even in smaller cases of things in my life, I find it really hard to sit and listen to things that aren't true about you.
For sure.
So after they come in, of course, the opening statements. We start with Jim Hardin, the chief prosecutor, and his opening statement. So Jim Hardin says it's pretense and appearances. That's what this case is about. It's about a tragic accident versus a horrible, painful death at the hands of her husband. So Jim Hardin shows a picture of Kathleen, a happy picture from the recent past. Says this is what Kathleen looked like if you were to meet her in the grocery store or out on the street. And then he shows pictures of her at the bottom of the steps on December 9th, 2001. Pretty horrifying picture. She had a lot of blood. She sprawled out at the bottom of the stairs. Not a pleasant picture, obviously. Then it goes from bad to worse. He shows the autopsy picture where her head is shaved and you can see the lacerations on the back of her head.
So he's getting maximum mileage out of that.
He is. It's hard to look at. So
yeah.
That's his job, though. He's doing a good job with that.
Well, he wants people to be sympathetic towards the deceased person.
Absolutely.
And that's going to work.
So his next move is that he brings out a blowpoke and shows it to the jury. It is Kathleen's sister Candace's blowpoke, which is a fireplace tool.
I was going to ask what a blowpoke was.
It's a long hollow tube, and it has a hook on the end, and you can blow, I guess, to get the fire going.
So you can kind of rearrange logs and blow through it to get the fire.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he brings her blowpoke, Candace's blowpoke, out, and he presents it to the jury as a match or replica of what they say is the murder weapon. Now, they say this because Kathleen's sister had bought several blowpokes for her family 15 years previously, one included for Kathleen, so Kathleen had had one as well. And the twist to this is that Kathleen's blowpoke was not found in the house or on the Peterson property. So the prosecution proposes that it was the murder weapon and it is mysteriously gone at the time of Kathleen's death.
I'm sorry, I just don't see how that gets allowed, that we have this copy of a blowpoke, even though we don't have the original one. How can you even begin to say this is the probable murder weapon?
Well, I don't know, because it wasn't found on the property. So if they say that Michael Peterson killed her with the blowpoke and now it's gone, where did the blowpoke go?
Right. And I'd want to see a blowpoke covered with blood and hair and stuff before I'd say, oh, yeah, that's the murder weapon.
Right.
So they're surmising that that's the murder weapon, and even though we don't have it, that's what did it. It just doesn't sound like something that I would allow into evidence.
Well, it was allowed. It was definitely allowed. So then we have David Rudolph's opening statement, the defense lawyer. So he talks about the Peterson happy family, the loving couple, the soulmates. He also says there's no murder weapon found there. If it was the blowpoke, where is it? Which is what I just said.
No kidding.
So he goes ahead. He's kind of pulling at the heartstrings of what a great family they were, what kind of love and trust there was between the two people, Michael and Kathleen, of course. So he reads a 1999 statement from Caitlin Atwater, who is Kathleen Peterson's biological daughter. And she is the one who went on the prosecutor's side after about a year and moved out of the house. So he reads a statement from Caitlin where she says that Michael brought happiness back to her mother's life after Caitlin's father had left them. She said her mother used to cry every night, but Michael brought happiness back into Kathleen's life.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yes, it was.
And even though this is a daughter who turned against him at the time, still thought they were a loving family.
Yes. Now, this statement was before Kathleen died. But after Kathleen died, we know that she was the family spokesperson.
Until somehow she got to the opinion that Michael killed her mother.
Right. So David Rudolph also says that Kathleen, after drinking some wine and taking a Valium, trying to walk up the stairs in flip-flops, she fell down the stairs and died tragically, and that's what it was. It was an accident.
And the autopsy doesn't help, to me, make it a homicide. And again, there's no skull fractures, there's no bleeding in the brain or skull. I can see where it could be consistent with a fall down the stairs.
Okay. Well, I'd like to talk about the lawyers and their different approaches, and then maybe we can go over the autopsy results on Elizabeth Ratliff before we go on.
Good idea.
So when we're speaking of the opening statement, Jim Harden, very somber, which would be expected, showing respect for the deceased, showing very disturbing photos, which is fair. This is what happened to her. It is disturbing. I think some of the things that got him clout with the jury was that he does have a southern accent, and he uses some of the southern phrasing. He says, "This is where the rubber meets the road." Kind of a little bit Dr. Phil-ish, using these down-home kind of phrases with people.
Yeah, he's just a good old boy.
Yes, so he does kind of present that way. Then we have David Rudolph, who seems more to be pointing out the facts, the lack of evidence. To me, he came across somewhat cynical, analytical, more of a city guy. By the way, he got his law degree at NYU School of Law and did his undergrad at Rutgers, so that makes sense.
Yeah, so he's a northerner.
Yes.
I mean, I think he practiced in Durham or in the South Carolina area.
Yes, yes.
North Carolina area.
But he originally is not from the South.
Yeah, and he comes across that way. He comes across as kind of a brash New York guy.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know if I agree about brash, but I don't think he's down home.
Nope.
Like the
he definitely isn't.
Prosecutors.
And we know how the Southern people love their down home people.
Well, we all love people that we can relate to, in all fairness.
Okay.
Okay. So what I'd like you to do is let's go over Elizabeth Ratliff's autopsy. We know that the finding was for homicidal attack, but can you go over some of the details of her examination and what you think?
Sure. And again, I'm not a pathologist. I am a physician, but not that kind of physician.
Right.
So take this for what you want.
Yes. I will not hold you to anything.
Okay. But having said that, I'm struck by the same kind of similarities with Kathleen's death. I mean, they determined or somehow determined that it was the result of a homicide. There's some kind of superficial lacerations on her scalp. There are absolutely no skull fractures, which I would expect to see if she had been beaten and thrown downstairs.
Well, we saw that with Kathleen's autopsy. That
right. Very similar.
It was a very, very unusual for someone to die of a beating and not have skull fractures.
Right.
Pretty much never happens.
Yeah, and I thought they covered that pretty well when he mentioned to the pathologist in Kathleen's autopsy results that in basically 100% of cases that were due to beatings, there was skull fractures, and
yes,
not in Kathleen's. And there's no skull fractures in Elizabeth Ratliff's.
So what about the idea that she had a stroke or an aneurysm?
Well, they did find blood in the cranium inside the skull. There's evidence of an intracerebral bleed because there was blood in the ventricles and in the spinal fluid. So, again, I'm not sure how I can equate that with homicide. I think it could be an aneurysm, although they mentioned in the autopsy they couldn't find any vessel damage, but that doesn't rule it out. And she could have had a stroke with bleed.
Now back to Kathleen's autopsy. It said that she had red neurons. I can't talk today. So red neurons, from what I read, it has something to do with the length of time that oxygen is kept from the brain?
Yeah, red neurons are just an indicator of a time without oxygenation. So there's a necrosis or death of cells setting in. Okay. That's nonspecific.
Okay. We'll get back to that when we get back to the medical examiner. What was her name? Radish?
Yeah, Dr. Radish.
Is it Radish? Do you say it like the vegetable?
I think so.
I think you do. Deborah Radish. Okay.
R-A-D-I-C-H or something like that.
Yep, that's correct. So one of the prosecution's early witnesses is the 911 operator who spoke to Michael Peterson when he called in the morning of December 9th. She says that he was hysterical.
He was. We heard that.
Yes. One thing that she says that the prosecution seems to be wanting to make something of is that he hung up on her twice. Now, they play the 911 call for the jury, and we notice Margaret crying and sobbing in the courtroom. It's really hard to watch. And we hear that he hangs up the first time after talking to the operator, and then the operator calls him back. And when he answers, when the operator calls back, he says, "Where are you? When are you getting here?" Something like that. So I don't know if that really, what do you think? Does that go to the prosecutor's idea that he was faking it and trying not to get help?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, here's a guy who's just found his wife dead or near death at the bottom of a stairway, and he's trying to resuscitate her or revive her and help her, and he's trying to call 911 at the same time. I don't see anything that's suspicious about him hanging up. Maybe he was tending to his wife.
Yes, because he did say she was bleeding when he first, when he first found her.
Yeah. So I don't, again, it's, that doesn't do anything for me. It means intent or suspicion that he hung up. And even if he hung up several times.
Yes.
And he's got an emergency on his hands. And he's notified the people at the 911 call, so assuming there's an ambulance or something on the way, then why stay on the phone and keep talking to them?
Right. Now, this documentary seems to kind of list to the side of the defense. I don't know if you got that impression.
That they're pro-defense?
Yes. A little bit.
Well, let me just say that the episodes I've seen so far, the defense has done a better job than the prosecution.
Yeah.
At least the way it's presented.
Well, that's the thing. It's edited before we see it, so we're not seeing the whole thing.
Sure.
But when they leave the courtroom after this 911 call, examining and cross-examining, they come to a little part where Michael Peterson's playing some classical music. He's talking to his son, Clayton. He's smoking his pipe, and he's kind of waxing philosophical with Clayton about things about, well, when you get older in life, you lose your ego and you worry about your family members more than yourself. Here's the beautiful music I wanted played at Kathleen's funeral. And they make him almost endearing. And I don't know how manipulative this is, but it does seem to kind of endear us to the defense.
Well, sure.
Yes.
But I don't know that it was intentional on the filmmaker's part.
No, we don't know that for sure, but it kind of seems that way.
Well, they want to show
how he was dealing with things. The documentary crew was spending time with the defense and with Michael Peterson. They weren't going home with Jim Harden and the detectives.
Well, I don't know.
Well,
they had plenty of interviews and statements from Harden and the other prosecutors.
Well, I'd say 1 out of 10.
No, it's not 1 out of 10.
You don't think so?
No. But I don't think it's 50-50 by any means.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So we get to trial days 13 through 17. And the subtitle on that section is Too Much Blood for a Fall. So we come in to a policeman from the scene being interviewed by the prosecutor. He's asking him the condition of the blood, how much blood was there. So this policeman, Dan George, who was a crime scene investigator, he said the blood appeared dried and too much blood for a fall.
Well, wait a minute. How much is too much in a fall?
Well, he claims that he has been at many of them and this was just too much for a fall.
But if you've fallen and hit your head a few times, you can bleed profusely from scalp wounds.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, how many falls downstairs has he investigated and he knows that there's too much blood for a fall? See, I sound like the people in the film that I'm sticking up for the defense, but I don't know how you can just look at the crime scene or the accident scene and say, oh, there's too much blood here. Can't be how it's described. Must be something worse.
Okay. And another thing is that he said that the blood appeared dry, but he did not touch the blood. So no one felt to see if the blood was dry, and it was not in his report that the blood was dry. So when he gets cross-examined, he gets pretty much torn apart.
Well, I would think.
Yes. One thing that Rudolph finds with his investigator, Ron Garrett, is that several photos taken by the investigators did not match. You have skeletonized bloodstains, which are blood drops where the center is gone, like it's been wiped out. I guess that's the only way they get that way, right? Is because there's been some cleanup or something?
Yeah, like they're trying to wipe them off.
Yeah. So you have skeletonized stains and the filled-in stains. And in different pictures of the same objects in the crime scene, you have some stains that are filled in, and in other areas they're skeletonized, as if they'd been touched.
Right. So that certainly calls into question their reliability. If things, they go from one picture to another, and in one picture they look like bloodstains, and the other one they're just circles.
Yes. So the pictures were taken on the 9th, 10th, and 11th of December. Some of them were not dated at all. So the scene was disturbed. Some photos showed blood on certain areas, and then in other pictures there was no blood. For example, on a cabinet door, you'd see a drop of blood in a picture. Then you'd see the exact same cabinet door with no blood.
Right. So you wonder what happened.
Okay. So this I thought was kind of funny because this is when Rudolph said, Dan George said, well, that's a glitch in the picture. So then they go on and on finding more inconsistencies, and Rudolph says...
A lot of glitches?
Yeah, you reckon that was another glitch? So that really, I thought Dan George's testimony was really destroyed by that cross-examination.
Yeah, for sure. That wasn't anything what the prosecutors wanted.
Right.
That was a bad mistake.
So watching that testimony, I would feel like that policeman was made unbelievable. It kind of destroyed his credibility or his professionalism, at least.
I would look at it that way.
So we see the Nancy Grace show that evening, and Nancy Grace is interviewing her correspondent reporter who was in the courtroom. And the correspondent is saying, well, there were footprints, but then they weren't there in the picture, so Michael Peterson must have washed them off.
Yeah, but that wasn't what transpired in the courtroom.
No.
So this is just non-existent stuff.
Oh, yeah. Rudolph went nuts. He called the station. He said, I can see Nancy Grace saying things like that, but this is your correspondent. Is she even in the same room? Is she even at the same trial?
Well, maybe not we all, but some of us don't have a very high opinion of Nancy Grace. She's kind of a publicity media whore. So I don't watch her. If I am forced to watch her, I take what she says with a grain of sand.
Or salt.
Or salt. Or nothing.
Or nothing. Just don't take her at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, she's definitely pro-victim.
Absolutely.
Regardless of the circumstances.
She's got them all convicted already.
That's right. So then we go ahead to trial days 22 to 25, and we have the prosecution blood spatter analyst taking the stand, and his name is Deaver. So his opinion is it was the scene of a beating consistent with beatings he has been at crime scenes of before. Now, I can't remember how many he said he's been at, but he said he's been at least 15. So we have videos of Deaver's attempts to recreate the blood spatter patterns at the scene. And we have an interview with Tim Palmbach, who's a forensic expert. Now, if you watch these attempts with Deaver and his team trying to recreate the blood spatter patterns, what they're doing is they're working to get a certain end product that will match what they want it to say. So this goes totally against scientific method, wouldn't you say?
It's almost laughable watching their attempts to recreate the accident scene.
Yeah.
I mean, they're doing all these things that you can tell are designed to get the results that they want and not what could have happened. So it's just something I wouldn't even regard at all. I would just discount everything that this guy says.
Well, according to Tim Palmbach and everything that I know about the scientific method, is when you're doing an experiment, you're not trying for a certain result. You're doing the experiment so you can accept an objective result at the end of it.
Right. You're trying to do an experiment to see if the result is consistent with what was found at the crime scene.
Right.
And you're not trying to do something to match the crime scene. You're just trying to see if it looks like it could have happened that way. And what they were doing was so artificial, it's almost laughable.
Yes, they had a sponge, which was soaked with some kind of blood, fake blood.
Yeah, I love that.
They would take an item similar to the blowpoke and swing at it. But they would not swing it over their head. Like if you're beating someone, you think it would swing all the way up over your head and really get, you know, your muscle into it, I would think. But they would just kind of lift it 6 inches and hit the sponge of blood.
Yeah, they were doing these little girly swing type things.
That's right. And I think the reason they were doing that is because at the scene there was no cast off blood spatter on the ceiling, which would obviously happen if you're lifting your arms above your head when you're hitting.
Well, sure. So they're trying to do the test to jibe with the results that they have.
Yes. So Deaver said...
And that's not how you would beat someone to death, is by little half swings.
Well, you wouldn't think so.
No, you'd be swinging away, man.
Well, I think Rudolph asked something like, is this how you would beat someone? And Deaver said, well, that's not the point. The point is that we were trying to get matching spatter. So that was just baffling.
Yeah. Deaver's the other one that didn't come off well on cross-examination.
Yes, but the jury seemed to believe him. So they said that, Deaver said that Peterson was outside of the stairway. So it's this narrow little stairway area. And he said that Peterson was actually standing outside of the doorway and swinging from there. But there were no dents or dings on the walls. And when Rudolph asked him, well, how would you get no... what is it called? Blood spatter.
Spatter.
Cast off blood spatter. If you had gotten it on the ceiling, how could that happen? And Deaver actually said, well, if you clean the weapon between swings,
yeah,
there wouldn't be any cast off.
So, okay, let's just wail away, wipe the weapon clean, hit again, wipe it clean, hit again. Give me a break.
Yeah, well, Rudolph actually acted that out, and it was preposterous. So, also, Deaver didn't analyze the spatter on Michael Peterson's dark blue polo shirt because he said he couldn't see the blood. Now, Rudolph said to him, are you aware that there are methods that you can see that will help you to see the blood on a dark object?
And he wasn't.
He said he wasn't, but then as they got further into it, we find out that a Lumalite test was done on the shirt.
And it was negative.
And it was negative. Now, he says he wrote a report for that and gave it to the prosecutor, but it was not in the evidence.
Well, well, well.
Yes. So the Lumalite report from Deaver to Jim Harden, Deaver said that as far as he knew, he gave it to Harden. Harden has no recollection of getting it, and obviously no report was put into evidence. But that seems like a pretty big point, that there was no blood on the shirt.
No kidding. And again, even if Michael was beating her, there has to be some spatter. Even if he's beating her with his little girly beats.
Right. Well, you know what Nancy Grace had to say about that with her correspondent that night?
No. What did Nancy have to say?
She said, well, it seems to me he must have changed his shirt.
Well, sure. in between the times when he was calling 911 and the police and rescue people arrived, he quickly ran upstairs, changed shirts, and came back down.
And if that's the case, where's the shirt he was wearing when he killed her? Is it with the blowpoke somewhere?
Probably, because neither of them are around.
So there's a heartbreaking little section of the film here where we see Margaret going over home videos of her family since she'd been living with Michael and Kathleen. And she's looking at home videos, and none of her home videos since 1999 show any blowpoke by the fireplace at their Christmas movies and things. So she's trying to document that for the defense.
So the blowpoke had been missing for at least a couple years, or wasn't where it was supposed to be.
Right, that's what it seems like. If it wasn't by the fireplace, I don't know where it was.
Yeah, it's not out by the barbecue.
No, unless he was hiding it for that perfect night when he was going to commit the murder.
Well, that's it.
It might be.
He was just waiting for the opportunity. He was going to bring a blowpoke out, do the deed, and then hide it back away again.
Right. I don't know. I don't want to sound like we're too much on the defense's side, because there are many things that go in the favor of the prosecution. There are some fishy things, but as far as this part about the blood evidence, I really find the prosecution's evidence to be flimsy.
Well, so far, I would be solidly on the defense side.
Okay.
Because the people that have been giving evidence so far are just not real believable. Particularly this blood spatter expert. He seems very sloppy and not someone I'd trust.
So what do you make of the two deaths at the bottom of the stairs?
I think those are coincidental.
Well, I think that they could be coincidental.
And I know the prosecution thinks they're related, and somehow they found people who say that they're both due to homicide. And Michael Peterson, in both cases, was the last person to be with the deceased.
Right.
So that part doesn't look so good. But
no.
It's so far not a good case for the prosecution, I don't think.
So who's the next witness? The medical examiner.
Now the one she's previously testified about Kathleen's death.
Yes. Deborah Radish.
And now she's testifying about Elizabeth's death?
Yes. She's the one, I think, that did it. Didn't she do the second autopsy of Elizabeth Ratliff?
Yep.
Okay.
Now, so I guess the evidence was decided to be allowed?
Oh, yes. They did bring it in, yeah.
Okay.
So she says there are 7 laceration areas that are full thickness to the skull and not consistent with the fall down the stairs, but consistent with being struck by the blowpoke. Now this is, we're still on Kathleen here. This is Kathleen's autopsy.
That's Kathleen.
Yes. So Rudolph goes back 10 years and looks at all the beating deaths in North Carolina, which is over 250 cases in the last 10 years. And he finds that no other cases of beating deaths are there without skull fractures or massive brain injuries.
Right. I think I mentioned that.
Yes, he did.
That on Kathleen.
Yes.
No skull fractures.
Right.
Extensive scalp wounds.
Yes.
But no skull fractures, no intracerebral bleeds. So that's tough to see.
Yeah, I thought that was a really good point that he made. So he cross-examines Radish and gives her the autopsy results from 1991 to 2003. And says that 257 cases without a single case documented, without a skull fracture and cerebral edema. He brings up an earlier case of Clayton Johnson, which was a similar case where he did go to prison and then the case was reviewed and it was determined that the person was killed by a fall and not a beating. Yeah.
So here again, the defense is coming across as scoring points.
Yes.
On this.
So now we have the prosecution bringing up Candace Zamperini, who's Kathleen's sister, and she's coming up to testify. So she says in 1984 she bought blowpokes for her family members because she liked hers. And then...
So what? This is all evidence that doesn't matter. I mean, you have to show the blowpoke was the murder weapon. The fact that family members had blowpokes without evidence that's linking it to Kathleen's death doesn't help me. So go away. You can't come to me with that.
Well, they did come with that, and they actually hammered this in, that it was the missing blowpoke. Where is it? It must have been the weapon.
Okay.
So she's cross-examined by Rudolph, and this is, she's cross-examined by Rudolph, and he brings up a statement that was written by Candace on January 10th, 2001, when she says that Michael Peterson and her sister Kathleen had a truly loving and respectful marriage. I'm sorry, this is January 10th, 2002. I made a mistake there. So it's about a month after Kathleen's death, when Candace made a statement that they had a truly loving, respectful marriage, and she didn't think that Michael had anything to do with it.
So what turned her?
Well, she says that all this stuff that came out about his personal life afterwards, the bisexuality, the lie about how he was injured when he was running for mayor, and when Jim Harden recrosses, he says, "Do you still feel that they had a truly loving, respectful marriage?" And Candace says, "No, at this point in time, I really have no idea who Michael Peterson is."
Okay.
So now might be a good time to talk about the bisexuality issues. Now, what have we said previously about this?
Well, we've said that he's definitely bisexual.
Yes.
And he had lovers who were male during his marriage to Kathleen.
Yes.
But that she was aware of his proclivities and it didn't matter to her.
Mm-hmm.
Gospel according to Mike.
So the defense tries to keep the homosexual emails, which is all they really have as any kind of proof of his bisexual tendencies, is some emails that he shared with a couple of young men. So the defense has a motion to keep this homosexual emails out of the case, says they will work against their client.
For sure.
Right? They're just going to make him look bad and they're not relevant to the case at all.
Right.
But the prosecution says that this is relevant because the fact that he was looking for sex elsewhere would mean that he's not fully satisfied and happy in his marriage. He might not be fully committed to his wife. And guess what Judge Hudson says?
Judge Hudson says, "I'll allow that testimony."
Yes, he agrees with the
Holy cow, what a surprise.
Yep. So the emails, and the emails that they really concentrated on in the documentary were emails with a young man named Brant, who went by the online title of Soldier Top. What they did was that he had some emails with Mike, but they never even actually met. Go ahead.
So, this is a guy who corresponded with Michael?
Yes, this was a guy on an adult website.
And were they going to meet?
They had planned on meeting, yes.
But they never did.
But they didn't. They didn't. But they said it was not Mike's decision that they didn't meet. It was actually Brant's decision, who's the young man.
Okay.
So the prosecution, on the 37th day of trial, calls Brant up, and he's the escort. They ask him, "Are you an escort? Were you on a website? Blah, blah, blah. Did Michael Peterson mention his wife in the emails? And what did you discuss?" So Brant says, "We discussed getting together and having anal sex." So when they get to the cross, Rudolph says, "Were most of your clients married men?" Brant says, "Yes, actually, most of them were married men."
Sure, they're closeted gay guys or bisexual guys.
Yeah, and Rudolph says, "Would you say that most of these men were predominantly bisexual?" And Brant says, "I would go as far as to say that most of these married men were predominantly straight with homosexual tendencies."
Okay, maybe that's true, but I don't think that the escort is the person who can make that diagnosis.
No, but in Michael Peterson's defense, he does say that Mike Peterson told him he had a very great, loving relationship with his wife, and nothing would ever change that. But he was bisexual, and there's nothing he could do about that. So That was
okay.
That was the gist of it.
I'll buy that stuff.
Yes. And to the defense's dismay, I got it right this time. The jury was allowed to read the emails and see the pornographic pictures, which were sent to Michael Peterson from Soldier Top.
Okay.
So Michael Peterson's online name was W.P. Ryder. They were fairly graphic.
I haven't seen them.
Okay.
But graphic or not, I mean, if he's able to get the point in that Michael Peterson said that he had a good marriage, that scores points for me.
Well, I would think so, and I don't think that this Brandt had anything to gain by saying that.
No.
He doesn't really even know him. So the jury's reading the emails, and you can see some of those older ladies especially are making faces when they read them, not thrilled with the...
Well, yeah.
So it's not great for Michael Peterson. And then, of course, we had Nancy Grace again that night, and what do you think she said about this?
She's ready to convict him. She's thinking, oh, these pornographic stuff or the bisexual stuff means that they had a troubled marriage and he did it. No question.
Yes. It was even mentioned by the prosecution that it could be like a love triangle.
But, sure.
I mean, there was no relationship, according to even the emails that were written long before Kathleen died. I don't know. I guess a lot of it depends on if you can believe, or if people in the jury can believe, that a marriage can function happily with one person having bisexual or relationships with people of the same sex or sexual encounters with people of the same sex.
Well, I think there's any number of instances where there's open marriages, and whether it's heterosexual or homosexual sex, there's people or marriages that are okay with that, and they function quite well.
Yeah, I think what really worked against him here is there was no one to testify that Kathleen knew. He was the only one. I mean, if he'd had a couple of her friends that said, yes, Kathleen knew about it, then I think that would really put an end to the prosecution's motive.
Well, no question. That would defuse it pretty quickly.
Yeah, so that's very uncertain. I think that really worked against him, which is, who knows if she did know, actually. But anyway, next we go to Candace and Lori, who are Kathleen's sisters, who are grieving and angry, and we see them go to Kathleen's gravesite, and they're very much like, this is for you, sister, we're going to get some roses for you, and we're going to get justice for you.
Now, Candace is the one that's been the most vocal about condemning Mike.
She has.
What about Lori? Has she said anything?
Oh, yeah. She's on the same boat. And okay. She probably did testify, but they didn't show it in the documentary.
So both of Kathleen's sisters feel like Mike killed her.
Yeah, and they're angry, which I think is very understandable. They want someone to pay for Kathleen's untimely death.
Well, I can see that.
I think when given a target for their anger, they're going to point it at him.
Yep, they will.
And, you know, maybe with good reason.
Not so far.
Okay, well, we have a ways to go. We're at trial day 39, and this is when Judge Hudson allows the prosecutor's admission of the Elizabeth Ratliff case as part of Kathleen's murder trial.
So did he give reasons for allowing this testimony?
He just said it was relevant.
Okay.
Okay. Well, probably because the...
Well, I guess if you're going to go by what the medical examiner says, then it is relevant.
Yes. So the person, they have people who came in from Germany to testify, and Margaret and Martha's former nanny, who worked for Elizabeth Ratliff, she's the one that found Elizabeth at the bottom of the stairs back in 1985. And she testifies that she came in and there was a great deal of blood. Also, there's a friend, Amy Beth Berner, that was a neighbor, and she says that she saw blood all over the floor and the walls. She also says that Michael said, when she asked what happened, Michael said to her that Elizabeth had had a brain aneurysm.
So he knew that, or he's just surmising that?
Well, the thing about this, we get to cross-examination with Tom Maher, and he is talking to Amy Beth Berner. So I want you to picture Amy Beth Berner, because she really had an effect on me. So you know who she reminded me of was Laura Dern. And if you've seen a show on, I think it's on HBO called Enlightenment with Laura Dern, which she's, you know, very flaky. She's got the long, kinky hair. She's talking from outer space a little bit. So she says there's that Michael said this. And we have another friend, Cheryl Apple Schumacher, who also agrees that there was blood. But she also says that Ratliff did have severe headaches days beforehand. So in the cross-examination of Amy Beth, it's found out that she never went to the police, although she says she was very suspicious that it was a crime scene. She says, I told everyone, this is a crime scene, don't touch anything. But there was nothing in her statement like that.
So it's easy to say after the fact that I thought it was a crime scene, but she didn't do anything at the time that it occurred.
No, she hadn't said anything since 1985, and in 1985, she did not mention that Michael said anything about the brain aneurysm. She also didn't mention any blood on the floor and the walls. So when she was cross-examined by Tom Maher, she said that she was having flashbacks of memories that she hadn't had before, just coming back to the United States and meeting with some of the people that were there at the time, brought her these flashbacks. And of course, Maher just jumped on that. You're having flashbacks? He loved that.
Well, I love recovered memory things. They're just so non-existent.
Yes. So she said, well, actually some of them were actually in color, she said, which made them all the more believable.
Well, sure. Color's always better than black and white.
Right. So when he says, well, if you thought this was a crime scene, why didn't you say something earlier between 1985 and 2002? Then she says, well, I've had to live with this my whole life. But she never explains why. She never reported anything or her concerns prior to that. So I just wonder, that's why I prefer the blood and the factual evidence, because I feel like people's memories and the way people remember things is just so off base from reality.
There's no question about that. Memory is really difficult.
Especially 17 years ago.
Particularly 17 years in the past.
Another point was that Amy Beth and Cheryl and the nanny Barbara, they'd all gotten together for dinner and chatted about this. So yeah. I don't want to sound sexist because I'm a woman, but I know when three or four women get together for dinner and drinks, stories get a little bit elaborated.
Stories, they do.
You know, and you can really believe that you remember that. I'm not saying she's lying at all.
No, not intentionally anyway.
No, not intentionally.
I think that, like you said, if they're sitting there comparing stories, they can help each other remember things that may or may not have occurred.
Yes. Now, the doctor's report in Germany, a doctor came to the scene, said that the only blood was under her head from the lacerations, even though they did mention that she had a bleeding disorder, which I'm going to need to look it up because I'm not sure what her bleeding disorder was.
There's no evidence of a bleeding disorder.
Oh, really? In the autopsy?
In the autopsy results.
Okay. Now, how would you know from an autopsy if there's a bleeding
disorder? Well, they would do some blood work and could tell.
Oh, okay. And her tox screen, there were no drugs in her system or alcohol?
I didn't see any of those results, so I can't say either way.
Okay.
So I guess if there's no mention that it wasn't there.
Okay.
So she wasn't drunk or high on drugs.
Okay.
When she fell down the stairs or went down the stairs.
Yes. Well, she wasn't found until 8 a.m., and this is where Deborah Radish comes back in. And she's talking about the Elizabeth Ratliff autopsy now, which she spoke about Kathleen's earlier. And her, her determination was that Elizabeth died about 11 p.m. the night before. And then on cross-examination, David Rudolph asks her about rigor mortis.
Yeah, that's where you get kind of stiff and immobile.
Now, how long does it usually take for that to set in after death?
Well, it's within 12 hours, generally within 8 to 12 hours.
Okay.
So if they're saying she died around 11 p.m. and she was found at 8 a.m.
With no rigor.
With no rigor, then I would dispute or question whether she actually died around 11.
Yeah.
Because she should have been in full rigor mortis at that point.
Yes. So it seems more likely from that she had gotten up in the morning.
Oh, no question.
Now, the children were still asleep when she was found. And they were too small to say anything anyway. They were toddlers. But the prosecutor said that she was dead for a very long time before Michael Peterson called 911. So the implication there is that Michael killed her the night before he went home. Because remember, we talked about how he stayed a little later after dinner to tuck the girls in and read them a story.
Right.
And then one of the questions was he having an affair with Elizabeth? So what the prosecution is getting at is that he killed her the night before, went home, and then she was found in the morning. But if she was not stiff, that doesn't make any sense.
No, I wouldn't think he killed her before he went home, and she lay there at the base of the stairs all night. She should have been in rigor.
Yes.
And if she died earlier in the morning, well, or later in the morning, closer to waking time, normal waking time, she wouldn't be stiff.
So, of course, the prosecution recrosses, and Deborah Radish sticks to her story that she had probably died around 11 p.m. with no real explanation of why there was no rigor.
See, that's two times she's testified. I'm not impressed with her.
Well, she doesn't really explain some of the inaccuracies in her testimony.
No, she doesn't.
No. So it's at this point, it's a Friday afternoon, and the prosecution has called all of its...
All their witnesses?
People, witnesses, and they rest. They say the prosecution rests its case at this point.
Okay.
And Judge Hudson turns to the defense. Do you have any evidence? And the defense says, we're not sure yet, but if we do, we'll be ready to present it on Monday.
Okay.
So the court will readjourn on Monday.
So we're going to take the weekend off.
Yep.
Defense is going to decide if they're going to put up any witnesses or decide if Michael Peterson's going to take the stand himself.
Yeah, another issue with this is that even Judge Hudson in the beginning had thought that Rudolph would apply for a change of venue because there's just so much discrimination or preconceived notions about Michael Peterson in Durham. But it was never, he never tried to get a change of venue, and the jury was not sequestered either.
So they were free to read all the papers and see all the Nancy Grace shows and everything.
Well, they may have been told not to, but that doesn't guarantee anything, does it?
Not at all.
No. So this is where episode 6 leaves off, and next week on True Crime Brewery, we're going to discuss the final 4 episodes of The Staircase, the trial of Michael Peterson for the murder of Kathleen Peterson. If you'd like to help us continue to bring you True Crime Brewery ad-free, visit us at www.patreon.com/truecrimebrewery, or go to our website, which is Tiegrabber Podcast, at www.tiegrabber.com/truecrimebrewery and become a subscriber for only $1 a month. You can use your PayPal account, and every little bit we really appreciate because we love to do this podcast and we don't want to have a bunch of ads. Although this is a little bit of an ad, it's not the same as trying to sell you crap. So if you have comments, questions, or any kind of feedback, you are welcome to leave a voicemail message on our website. Right through your computer or your cell phone, all you have to do is click on send voicemail and say what you want to say, and we'll get it right away. And I'd love to share any feedback you send on the air on True Crime Brewery on our next episode. Or you can shoot off an email in our forum or in our contact us section. Our email address is truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. Do you have anything else you'd like to say, Dick?
I'm done for now.
Okay, that's it. Until next
I'm liking
time.
The defense so far.
Okay. So until next time, I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Bye.
See ya.